there to catch her. Newt was okay, really. And the thing about spending the rest of your life with him was he wouldn't be around long enough to get on your nerves. The radio was talking about South American rainforests. New ones. It began to hail. Bullets of ice shredded the leaves around the them as Adam led them down into the quarry. Dog slunk along with his tail between his legs, whining. This wasn't right, he was thinking. Just when I was getting the hang of rats, just when I'd nearly sorted out that bloody German shepherd across the road. Now he's going to end it all, and I'll be back with the old glowing eyes and chasing lost souls. What's the sense in that? They don't fight back, and there's no taste to them. Wensleydale, Brian, and Pepper were not thinking quite so coherently. All that they were aware of was that they could no more not follow Adam than fly. To try to resist the force marching them forward would simply result in multiple broken legs, and they'd still have to march. Adam wasn't thinking at all. Something had opened in his mind and was aflame. He sat them down on the crate.
"We'll all be all right down here," he said.
Said Wensleydale. "Don't you think our mothers and fathers—"
"Oh, don't you worry about them," said Adam, loftily. "I can make some new ones. There won't be any of this being in bed by 9:30, either. You don't ever have to go to bed, ever, if you don't want to. Or tidy your room, or anything. You just leave it all to me, and it will be great."
He gave them a manic smile.
"I've got some new friends coming," he confided. "You'll like 'em."
"But,"
Wensleydale began. "You just think of all the amazing stuff afterwards," said Adam enthusiastically. "You can fill up America with all new cowboys and Indians and policemen and gangsters and cartoons and spacemen and stuff. Won't that be fantastic?"
Wensleydale looked miserably at the other two. They were sharing a thought that none of them would be able to articulate very satisfactorily, even in normal times. Broadly, it was that there had once been real cowboys and gangsters, and that was great. And there would always be pretend cowboys and gangsters, and that was also great. But real pretend cowboys and gangsters that were alive and not alive and could be put back in their box when you were tired of them, this did not seem great at all. The whole point about gangsters and cowboys and aliens and pirates was that you could stop being them and go home.
"But before all that," said Adam darkly, "we're really going to show 'em."
There was a tree in the plaza. It wasn't very big, and the leaves were yellow, and the light it got through the excitingly dramatic smoked glass was the wrong sort of light. And it was on more drugs than an Olympic athlete, and loudspeakers nested in the branches. But it was a tree, and if you half-closed your eyes and looked at it over the artificial waterfall, you could almost believe that you were looking at a sick tree through a fog of tears. Jaime Hernes liked to have his lunch under it. The maintenance supervisor would shout at him if he found out, but Jaime had grown up on a farm, and it had been quite a good farm, and he had liked trees, and he didn't want to have to come into the city. But what could you do? It wasn't a bad job, and the money was the kind of money his father hadn't dreamed of. His grandfather hadn't dreamed of any money at all. He hadn't even known what money was until he was 15. But there were times when you needed trees. And the shame of it, Jaime thought, was that his children were growing up thinking of trees as firewood, and his grandchildren would think of trees as history. But what could you do? Where there were trees now, there were big farms. Where there were small farms now, there were plazas. And where there were plazas, there were still plazas, and that's how it went. He hid his trolley behind the newspaper stand, sat down furtively, and opened his lunchbox. It was then that he became aware of the rustling and a movement of shadows across the floor. He looked around. The tree was moving. He watched it with interest. Jaime had never seen a tree growing before. The soil, which was nothing more than a scree of some sort of artificial chippings, was actually crawling as the roots moved around under the surface. Jaime saw a thin white shoot creep down the side of the raised garden area and prod blindly at the concrete of the floor. Without knowing why, without ever knowing why, he nudged it gently with his foot until it was close to the crack between the slabs. It found it and bored down. The branches were twisting into different shapes. Jaime heard the screech of traffic outside the building, but didn't pay it any attention. Someone was yelling something, but someone was always yelling in Jaime's vicinity, often at him. The questing root must have found the buried soil. It changed colour and thickened like a fire hose when the water is turned on. The artificial waterfall stopped running. Jaime visualized fractured pipes blocked with sucking fibres. Now he could see what was happening outside. The street surface was heaving like a sea. Saplings were pushing up between the cracks. Of course, he reasoned, they had sunlight. His tree didn't. All it had was the muted grey light that came through the dome 4 stories up. Dead light. But what could you do? You could do this. The elevators had stopped running because the power was off, but it was only 4 flights of stairs. Jaime carefully shut his lunchbox and padded back to his cart, where he selected his longest broom. People were pouring out of the building, yelling. Jaime moved amiably against the flow, like a salmon going upstream. A white framework of girders, which the architect had presumably thought made a dynamic statement about something or other, held up the smoked glass dome. In fact, it was some sort of plastic, and it took Jaime, perched on a convenient strip of girder, all his strength and the full leverage of the broom's length to crack it. A couple more swings brought it down in lethal shards. The light poured in, lighting up the dust in the plaza, so that the air looked as though it was full of fireflies. Far below, the tree burst the walls of its brushed concrete prison and rose like an express train. Jaime had never realized that trees made a sound when they grew, and no one else had realized it either, because the sound is made over hundreds of years, in waves, 24 hours from peak to peak. Speed it up, and the sound a tree makes is vroom. Jaime watched it come toward him like a green mushroom cloud. Steam was billowing out from around its roots. The girders never stood a chance. The remnant of the dome went up like a ping-pong ball on a water spray. It was the same all over the city, except that you couldn't see the city anymore. All you could see was the canopy of green. It stretched from horizon to horizon. Jaime sat on his branch, clung to a liana, and laughed and laughed and laughed. Presently, it began to rain. The Kapamaki, a whaling research ship, was currently researching the question, how many whales can you catch in 1 week? Except that today, there weren't any whales. The crew stared at the screens, which, by the application of ingenious technology, could spot anything larger than a sardine and calculate its net value on the international oil market, and found them blank. The occasional fish that did show up was barreling through the water as if in a great hurry to get elsewhere. The captain drummed his fingers on the console. He was afraid that he might soon be conducting his own research project to find out what happened to a statistically small sample of whaler captains who came back without a factory ship full of research material. He wondered what they did to you. Maybe they locked you in a room with a harpoon gun and expected you to do the honourable thing. This was unreal. There ought to be something. The navigator punched up a chart and stared at it. "Honourable sir," he said. "What is it?" said the captain testily. "We seem to have a miserable instrument failure. Seabed in this area should be 200 metres.
"What of it?"
"I'm reading 15,000 metres, honourable sir. I'm still falling."
"That is foolish," There is no such depth.
The captain glared at several million yen worth of cutting-edge technology and thumped it. The navigator gave a nervous smile.
Ah, sir, he said. It is shallower already.
Beneath the thunders of the upper deep, as Aziravale and Tennyson both knew, far, far beneath, in the abysmal sea, the Kraken sleepeth. And now it was waking up. Millions of tons of deep ocean ooze cascade off its flanks as it rises.
See, said the navigator, 3,000 meters already.
The Kraken doesn't have eyes. There has never been anything for it to look at. But as it billows up through the icy waters, it picks up the microwave noise of the sea, the sorrowing beeps and whistles of the whale song.
Ah, said the navigator, 1,000 meters?
The Kraken is not amused.
500 meters?
The factory ship rocks on the sudden swell.
100 meters?
There is a tiny metal thing above it. The Kraken stirs. And 10 billion sushi dinners cry out for vengeance. The cottage windows burst inward. This wasn't a storm, it was war. Fragments of jasmine whirled across the room, mingled with the rain of file cards. Newt and Anathema clung to one another in the space between the overturned table and the wall. Go on, muttered Newt, tell me Agnes predicted this.
She did say, he bringeth the storm, said Anathema.
Well, this is a bloody hurricane. Did she say what's supposed to happen next?
2315 is cross-reference to 3477, said Anathema.
You can remember details like that at a time like this? Well, since you mention it, yes, she said.
She held out a card. 3477, let the wheel of fate turn, let hearts enjoin, there are other fires than mine. When the wind bloweth, the blossoms reach out one to another, for the calm cometh when red and white and black and pale approach to peace is our profession. And the family notes. Some mysticism here, one fears. A.F. Device, October 17, 1889. Peas, blossoms, O.F.D., 1929, September 4. Revelations chapter 6 again, I presume. Dr. Thomas Device, 1835. Newt read it again. There was a sound outside like a sheet of corrugated iron pinwheeling across the garden, which was exactly what it was. Is this supposed to mean, he said slowly, that we're supposed to become an item?
That Agnes? What a joker!
Courting is always difficult when the one being courted has an elderly female relative in the house. They tend to mutter or cackle or bum cigarettes or, in the worst cases, get out the family photograph album, an act of aggression in the sex war which ought to be banned by a Geneva Convention. It's much worse when the relative has been dead for 300 years. Newt had indeed been harbouring certain thoughts about Anathema. Well, not just harbouring them, in fact, but dry-docking them, refitting them, giving them a good coat of paint, and scraping the barnacles off their bottom. But the idea of Agnes's second sight boring into the back of his neck sloshed over his libido like a bucketful of cold water. He'd even been entertaining the idea of inviting her out for a meal, but he hated the idea of some Cromwellian witch sitting in her cottage 3 centuries earlier and watching him eat. He was in the mood in which people burned witches. His life was quite complicated enough without it being manipulated across the centuries by some crazed old woman. A thump in the grate sounded like part of the chimney stack coming down. And then he thought, my life isn't complicated at all. I can see it as clearly as Agnes might. It stretches all the way to early retirement, a whip round from the people in the office, a bright little neat flat somewhere, a neat little empty death.
except now I'm going to die under the ruins of a cottage during what might just possibly be the end of the world. The recording angel won't have any trouble with me. My life must have been dittos on every page for years.
I mean, what have I ever really done?
I've never robbed a bank. I've never had a parking ticket. I've never eaten Thai food. Somewhere another window caved in with a merry tinkle of breaking glass. Anathema put her arms around him with a sigh which really didn't sound disappointed at all.
I've never been to America. Or France, because Calais doesn't really count. I've never learned to play a musical instrument.
The radio died as the power lines finally gave up.
He buried his face in her hair. I've never...
There was a pinging sound. Shadwell, who had been bringing the army paybooks up to date, looked up in the middle of signing for Witchfinder Lance Corporal Smith. It took him a while to notice that the gleam of Newt's pin was no longer on the map. He got down from his stool, muttering under his breath, and searched around on the floor until he found it. He gave it another polish and put it back in Tadfield. He was just signing for Witchfinder Private Table, who got an extra tuppence a year hay allowance, when there was another ping. He retrieved the pin, glared at it suspiciously, and pushed it so hard into the map that the plaster behind it gave way. Then he went back to the ledgers. There was a ping. This time the pin was several feet from the wall. Shadwell picked it up, examined its point, pushed it into the map, and watched it. After about 5 seconds, it shot past his ear. He scrabbled for it on the floor, replaced it on the map, and held it there. It moved under his hand. He leaned his weight on it. A tiny thread of smoke curled out of the map. Shadwell gave a whimper and sucked his fingers as the red-hot pin ricocheted off the opposite wall and smashed a window. It didn't want to be in Tadfield. 10 seconds later, Shadwell was rummaging through the WA's cash box, which yielded a handful of copper, a 10-shilling note, and a small counterfeit coin from the reign of James I. Regardless of personal safety, he rummaged in his own pockets. The results of the trawl, even with his pensioner's concessionary travel pass taken into consideration, was barely enough to get him out of the house, let alone to Tadfield. The only other people he knew who had money were Mr. Rajit and Madame Tracy. As far as the Rajits were concerned, the question of 7 weeks' rent would probably crop up in any financial discussion he instigated at this point. And as for Madame Tracy, who'd only be too willing to lend him a handful of used tenors,
"I'll be swagger if I'll tuck the widges of Sin Frey the Pinted Jezebel," he said,
which left no one else, save one,
the Southern Pansy.
They'd each been here just once, spending as little time as possible in the room, and, in Aziraphale's case, trying not to touch any flat surface. The other one, the flash Southern bastard in the sunglasses, was, Shadwell suspected, not someone he ought to offend. In Shadwell's simple world, anyone in sunglasses who wasn't actually on a beach was probably a criminal. He suspected that Crowley was from the Mafia, or the underworld, although he would have been surprised how right he nearly was. But the soft one in the camel hair coat was a different matter, and he'd risked trailing him back to his base once, and he could remember the way. He thought Aziraphale was a Russian spy. He could ask him for money, threaten him a bit. It was terribly risky. Shadwell pulled himself together. Even now, young Newt might be suffering unimaginable tortures at the hands of the Daughters of Night, and he, Shadwell, had sent him.
"We cannot leave our people in there," he said,
and put on his thin overcoat and shapeless hat, and went out into the street. The weather seemed to be blowing up a bit. Aziraphale was dithering. He'd been dithering for some 12 hours. His nerves, he would have said, were all over the place.
He walked around the shop, picking up bits of paper and dropping them again, fiddling with pens. He ought to tell Crowley. No, he didn't. He wanted to tell Crowley. He ought to tell Heaven. He was an angel, after all. You had to do the right thing. It was built in. You see a while, you fought. Crowley had put his finger on it right enough. He ought to have told Heaven right from the start. But he'd known him for thousands of years. They got along. They nearly understood one another. He sometimes suspected they had far more in common with one another than with their respective superiors. They both liked the world, for one thing, rather than viewing it simply as a board on which the cosmic game of chess was being played. Well, of course, that was it. That was the answer, staring him in the face. It'd be true to the spirit of his pact with Crowley if he tipped Heaven the wink. And then they could quietly do something about the child. Although nothing too bad, of course, because we were all God's creatures when you got down to it. Even people like Crowley and the Antichrist. And the world would be saved, and there wouldn't have to be all that Armageddon business, which would do nobody any good anyway, because everyone knew Heaven would win in the end. And Crowley would be bound to understand. Yes. And then everything would be all right. There was a knock at the shop door, despite the closed sign. He ignored it. Getting in touch with Heaven for two-way communications was far more difficult for Aziraphale than it is for humans who don't expect an answer, and in nearly all cases would be rather surprised to get one. He pushed aside the paper-laden desk and rolled up the threadbare bookshop carpet. There was a small circle chalked on the floorboards underneath, surrounded by suitable passages from the Kabbalah. The angel lit seven candles, which he placed ritually at certain points around the circle. Then he lit some incense, which was not necessary, but did make the place smell nice. And then he stood in the circle and said the words. Nothing happened. He said the words again. Eventually, a bright blue shaft of light shot from the ceiling and filled the circle. A well-educated voice said,
"Well?"
"It's me, Aziraphale."
"We know,"
said the voice. "I've got great news. I've located the Antichrist. I can give you his address and everything." There was a pause. The blue light flickered.
"Well?"
it said again. "But, do you see, you can stop it all happening in the nick of time. You've only got a few hours. You can stop it all, and there needn't be war, and everyone would be saved." He beamed madly into the light.
"Yes?"
said the voice. "Yes. He's in a place called Lower Tadfield. And the address..."
"Well done," said the voice in flat, dead tones.
"There doesn't have to be any of that business with one-third of the seas turning to blood or anything," said Aziraphale happily. When it came, the voice sounded slightly annoyed.
"Why not?"
it said. Aziraphale felt an icy pit opening under his enthusiasm and tried to pretend it wasn't happening. He plunged on. "Well, you can simply make sure that..."
"We will win, Aziraphale."
"Well, yes, but..."
"The forces of darkness must be beaten. You seem to be under a misapprehension. The point is not to avoid the war. It is to win it. We have been waiting a long time, Aziraphale."
Aziraphale felt the coldness envelop his mind. He opened his mouth to say, "Do you think perhaps it would be a good idea not to hold the war on Earth?" and changed his mind. "I see," he said grimly. There was a scraping near the door, and if Aziraphale had been looking in that direction, he would have seen a battered felt hat trying to peer over the fanlight.
"This is not to say you have not performed well," said the voice. "You will receive a commendation. Well done."
"Thank you," said Aziraphale. The bitterness in his voice would have soured milk.
I'd forgotten about ineffability, obviously.
We thought you had.
May I ask, said the angel, to whom have I been speaking?
The voice said,
We are the Metatron.
Footnote. The voice of God, but not the voice of God, an entity in its own right, rather like a presidential spokesman.
Oh, yes, of course. Oh, well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Behind him, the letterbox tilted open, revealing a pair of eyes.
One other thing, said the voice. You will, of course, be joining us, won't you?
Well, of course. It has been simply ages since I've held a flaming sword,
Aziraphale began.
Yes, we recall, said the voice. You will have a lot of opportunity to relearn.
Ah, what sort of initiating event will precipitate the war? Said Aziraphale.
We thought a multi-nation nuclear exchange would be a nice start.
Oh, yes. Very imaginative.
Aziraphale's voice was flat and hopeless.
Good. We will expect you directly, then, said the voice.
Ah, well, I'll just clear up a few business matters, shall I?
Said Aziraphale desperately.
There hardly seems to be any necessity,
said the Metatron. Aziraphale drew himself up.
I really feel that probity, not to say morality, demands that as a reputable businessman I should...
Yes, yes,
said the Metatron a shade testily.
Point taken. We shall await you then.
The light faded, but did not quite vanish. They're leaving the line open, Aziraphale thought. I'm not getting out of this one.
But hello, he said softly. Anyone still there?
There was silence. Very carefully, he stepped over the circle and crept to the telephone. He opened his notebook and dialed another number. After four rings, it gave a little cough, followed by a pause, and then a voice which sounded so laid back you could put a carpet on it, said,
Hi, this is Anthony Crowley.
Crowley!
Aziraphale tried to hiss and shout at the same time.
Listen, I haven't got much time. The...
Probably not in right now, or asleep and busy, or something, but...
Shut up! Listen, it was in Tadfield. It's all in that book. You've got to stop.
After the tone, and I'll get right back to you. Ciao.
I want to talk to you now. Beep. Stop making noises. It's in Tadfield. That's what I was sensing. You must go there and...
He took the phone away from his mouth.
Bugger,
he said. It was the first time he'd sworn in more than 6,000 years.
But hold on. The demon had another line, didn't he? He was that kind of person.
Aziraphale fumbled in the book, nearly dropping it on the floor. They would be getting impatient soon. He found the other number. He dialed it. It was answered almost immediately, at the same time as the shop's bell tingled gently. Crowley's voice, getting louder as it neared the mouthpiece, said,
Really mean it, hello?
Crowley, it's me!
The voice was horribly non-committal. Even in his present state, Aziraphale sensed trouble.
Are you alone? He said cautiously.
No, I've got an old friend here. Listen!
Oh, here are ye, you spawn of hell!
Very slowly, Aziraphale turned around. Shadwell was trembling with excitement. He'd seen it all. He'd heard it all. He hadn't understood any of it, but he knew what people did with circles and candlesticks and incense. He knew that all right. He'd seen the devil rides out 15 times. 16 times if you included the time he'd been thrown out of the cinema for shouting his unflattering opinions of amateur witchfinder Christopher Lee. The buggers were using him. They'd been making fools out of the glorious traditions of the army.
"I'll have ye, you evil bastard!" he shouted, advancing like a moth-eaten avenging angel. "I ken what ye be about, coming up here and seducing women to do your evil will."
"I think perhaps you've got the wrong shop," said Aziraphale. "I'll call back later," he told the receiver, and hung up.
"I could see what ye were about," snarled Shadwell.
There were flecks of foam around his mouth. He was more angry than he could ever remember.
"Things are not what they seem," Aziraphale began, aware even as he said it that, as conversational gambits went, it lacked a certain polish.
"I bet they ain't,"
said Shadwell triumphantly.
No, I mean...
Without taking his eyes off the angel, Shadwell shuffled backwards and grabbed the shop door, slamming it hard so that the bell jangled.
"Bell!"
he said. He grabbed the nice and accurate prophecies and thumped it down heavily on the table.
"Book!"
he snarled. He fumbled in his pocket and produced his trusty Ronson.
"Practically candle!"
he shouted, and began to advance. In his path, the circle glowed with a faint blue light.
Said Aziraphale, "I think it might not be a very good idea to..."
Shadwell wasn't listening.
"By the powers invested in me, by virtue of my office of witch-finder,"
he intoned,
"I charge ye to quit from this place.
You see, the circle,
and return henceforth to the place from which ye came, pausing not to..."
"It would really be unwise for a human to set foot in it without..."
"And deliver us from evil.
Keep out of the circle, you stupid man.
Never to come again, to vex..."
"Yes, yes, but please, keep out of..."
Aziraphale ran toward Shadwell, waving his hands urgently.
"Returning, nay more."
Shadwell finished. He pointed a vengeful black-nailed finger. Aziraphale looked down at his feet and swore for the second time in 5 minutes. He'd stepped into the circle.
"Oh, fuck," he said.
There was a melodious twang, and the blue glow vanished. So did Aziraphale. 30 seconds went by. Shadwell didn't move. Then, with a trembling left hand, he reached up and carefully lowered his right hand.
"Hello?"
he said.
"Hello?"
No one answered. Shadwell shivered. Then, with his hand held out in front of him, like a gun that he didn't dare fire and didn't know how to unload, he stepped out into the street, letting the door slam behind him. It shook the floor. One of Aziraphale's candles fell over, spilling burning wax across the old dry wood. Crowley's London flat was the epitome of style. It was everything that a flat should be, spacious, white, elegantly furnished, and with that designer unlived-in look that only comes from not being lived in. This is because Crowley did not live there. It was simply the place he went back to at the end of the day when he was in London. The beds were always made, the fridge was always stocked with gourmet food that never went off. Well, that was why Crowley had a fridge, after all. And, for that matter, the fridge never needed to be defrosted, or even plugged in. The lounge contained a huge television, a white leather sofa, a video and laser disc player, an answer phone, 2 telephones, the answer phone line and the private line, a number so far undiscovered by the legions of telephone salesmen who persisted in trying to sell Crowley double glazing, which he already had, or life insurance, which he didn't need, and a square matte black sound system, the kind so exquisitely engineered that it just has the on-off switch and the volume control. The only sound equipment Crowley had overlooked was speakers. He'd forgotten about them. Not that it made any difference. The sound reproduction was quite perfect anyway. There was an unconnected fax machine with the intelligence of a computer, and a computer with the intelligence of a retarded ant. Nevertheless, Crowley upgraded it every few months, because a sleek computer was the sort of thing Crowley felt that the sort of human he tried to be would have. This one was like a Porsche with a screen. The manuals were still in their transparent wrapping. Footnote. Along with the standard computer warranty agreement, which said that if the machine, one, didn't work, two, didn't do what the expensive advertisement said, three, electrocuted the immediate neighbourhood, four, and in fact failed entirely to be inside the expensive box when you opened it, this was expressly, absolutely, implicitly, and in no event the fault or responsibility of the manufacturer, that the purchaser should consider himself lucky to be allowed to give his money to the manufacturer, and that any attempt to treat what had just been paid for as the purchaser's own property would result in the attentions of serious men with menacing briefcases and very thin watches. Crowley had been extremely impressed with the warranties offered by the computer industry, and had in fact sent a bundle below to the department that drew up the Immortal Soul agreements, with a yellow memo form attached, just saying, "Learn, guys." In fact, the only things in the flat Crowley devoted any personal attention to were the houseplants. They were huge and green and glorious, with shiny, healthy, lustrous leaves. This was because, once a week, Crowley went around the flat with a green plastic plant mister, spraying the leaves and talking to the plants. He had heard about talking to plants in the early 70s on Radio 4 and thought it an excellent idea. Although talking is perhaps the wrong word for what Crowley did. What he did was put the fear of God into them. More precisely, the fear of Crowley. In addition to which, every couple of months, Crowley would pick out a plant that was growing too slowly, or succumbing to leaf wilt, or browning, or just didn't look quite as good as the others, and he would carry it around to all the other plants. "Say goodbye to your friend," he'd say to them. He just couldn't cut it. Then he would leave the flat with the offending plant, and return an hour or so later with a large, empty flower pot, which he would leave somewhere conspicuously around the flat. The plants were the most luxurious, verdant, and beautiful in London. Also the most terrified. The lounge was lit by spotlights and white neon tubes, of the kind one casually props against a chair or a corner. The only wall decoration was a framed drawing, the cartoon for the Mona Lisa, Leonardo da Vinci's original sketch. Crowley had bought it from the artist one hot afternoon in Florence, and felt it was superior to the final painting. Footnote. Leonardo had felt so too. "I got a bloody smile right in the roughs," he told Crowley, sipping cold wine in the lunchtime sun. "But it went all over the place when I painted it. Her husband had a few things to say about it when I delivered it, but, like I tell him, Signor del Giocondo, apart from you, who's going to see it? Anyway, explain this helicopter thing again, will you?" Crowley had a bedroom and a kitchen and an office and a lounge and a toilet, each room forever clean and perfect. He had spent an uncomfortable time in each of these rooms during the long wait for the end of the world. He had phoned his operatives in the Witchfinder Army again to try to get news, but his contact, Sergeant Shadwell, had just gone out, and the dim-witted receptionist seemed unable to grasp that he was willing to talk to any of the others.
"Mr. Pulsifer is out too, love," she told him. "He went down to Tadfield this morning, on a mission."
"I'll speak to anyone," Crowley had explained.
"I'll tell Mr. Shadwell that," she had said, "when he gets back. Now, if you don't mind, it's one of my mornings, and I can't leave my gentleman like that for long, or he'll catch his death. And at two, I've got Mrs. Ormerod and Mr. Scroggy and young Julia coming over for a sitting. And there's the place to clean and all beforehand. But I'll give Mr. Shadwell your message."
Crowley gave up. He tried to read a novel, but couldn't concentrate. He tried to sort his CDs into alphabetical order, but gave up when he discovered they already were in alphabetical order, as was his bookcase and his collection of soul music. Footnote. He was very proud of his collection. It had taken him ages to put together. This was real soul music. James Brown wasn't in it. Eventually, he settled down on the white leather sofa and gestured on the television.
"Reports are coming in," said a worried newscaster. "Reports are, well, nobody seems to know what's going on, but reports available to us would seem to, indicate an increase in international tensions that would have undoubtedly been viewed as impossible this time last week when, everyone seemed to be, getting on so nicely. This would seem at least partly due to the spate of unusual events which have occurred over the last few days. Off the coast of Japan...
Crowley?
Yes,
admitted Crowley. What the hell is going on, Crowley? What exactly have you been doing?
How do you mean? Crowley asked, although he already knew.
The boy called Warlock. We have brought him to the fields of Megiddo. The dog is not with him. The child knows nothing of the Great War. He is not our master's son.
Ah, said Crowley.
Is that all you can say, Crowley? Our troops are assembled. The four beasts have begun to ride. But where are they riding to? Something has gone wrong, Crowley. And it is your responsibility. And in all probability, your fault. We trust you have a perfectly reasonable explanation for all this.
Oh, yes, agreed Crowley, readily. Perfectly reasonable.
Because you are going to have your chance to explain it all to us. You are going to have all the time there is to explain. And we will listen with great interest to everything you have to say. And your conversation, and the circumstances that will accompany it, will provide a source of entertainment and pleasure for all the damned of hell, Crowley. Because no matter how wrecked with torment, no matter what agonies the lowest of the damned are suffering, Crowley, you will have it worse.
With a gesture, Crowley turned the set off. The dull grey-green screen continued enunciating. The silence formed itself into words.
Do not even think about trying to escape us, Crowley. There is no escape. Stay where you are. You will be collected.
Crowley went to the window and looked out. Something black and car-shaped was moving slowly down the street toward him. It was car-shaped enough to fool the casual observer. Crowley, who was observing very carefully, noticed that not only were the wheels not going round, but they weren't even attached to the car. It was slowing down as it passed each house. Crowley assumed that the car's passengers, neither of them would be driving, neither of them knew how, were peering out at the house numbers. He had a little time. Crowley went into the kitchen and got a plastic bucket from under the sink. Then he went back into the lounge. The infernal authorities had ceased communicating. Crowley turned the television to the wall, just in case. He walked over to the Mona Lisa. Crowley lifted the picture down from the wall, revealing a safe. It was not a wall safe. It had been bought from a company that specialized in servicing the nuclear industry. He unlocked it, revealing an inner door with a dial-tumble lock. He spun the dial. 4004 was the code, easy to remember, the year he had slithered onto this stupid, marvellous planet, back when it was gleaming and new. Inside the safe were a thermos flask, two heavy PVC gloves of the kind that covered one's entire arms, and some tongs. Crowley paused. He eyed the flask nervously. There was a crash from downstairs. That had been the front door. He pulled on the gloves and gingerly took the flask and the tongs and the bucket, and, as an afterthought, he grabbed the plant mister from beside a luxuriant rubber plant and headed for his office, walking like a man carrying a thermos flask full of something that might cause, if he dropped it, or even thought about dropping it, the sort of explosion that impels greybeards to make statements like, "And where this crater is now, once stood the city of Washington," in science fiction B-movies. He reached his office, nudged open the door with his shoulder. Then he bent his legs and slowly put things down on the floor. Bucket, tongs, plant mister,
And finally, deliberately, the flask. A bead of sweat began to form on Crowley's forehead and trickled down into one eye. He flicked it away. Then, with care and deliberation, he used the tongs to unscrew the top of the flask. Carefully, carefully. That was it. A pounding on the stairs below him and a muffled scream. That would have been the little old lady on the floor below. He could not afford to rush. He gripped the flask with the tongs, and taking care not to spill the tiniest drop, he poured the contents into the plastic bucket. One false move was all it would take. There. Then he opened the office door about 6 inches and placed the bucket on top. He used the tongs to replace the top of the flask. Then, a crash from his outer hallway, pulled off the PVC gloves, picked up the plant mister, and settled himself behind his desk.
Crawley,
called a guttural voice.
Haster. He's through there, hissed another voice. I can feel the slimy little creep.
Ligger. Haster and Ligger. Now, as Crowley would be the first to protest, most demons weren't deep down evil. In the great cosmic game, they felt they occupied the same position as tax inspectors, doing an unpopular job, maybe, but essential to the overall operation of the whole thing. If it came to that, some angels weren't paragons of virtue. Crowley had met one or two who, when it came to righteously smiting the ungodly, smote a good deal harder than was strictly necessary. On the whole, everyone had a job to do and just did it. And on the other hand, you got people like Ligger and Haster, who took such a dark delight in unpleasantness, you might even have mistaken them for human. Crowley leaned back in his executive chair. He forced himself to relax and failed appallingly. "In here, people," he called.
"We want a word with you," said Ligger, in a tone of voice intended to imply that word was synonymous with horrifically painful eternity,
and the squat demon pushed open the office door. The bucket teetered, then fell neatly on Ligger's head. Drop a lump of sodium in water, watch it flame and burn and spin around crazily, flaring and sputtering. This was like that, just nastier. The demon peeled and flared and flickered. Oily brown smoke oozed from it, and it screamed and it screamed and it screamed. Then it crumpled, folded in on itself, and what was left lay glistening on the burnt and blackened circle of carpet, looking like a handful of mashed slugs.
"Hi," said Crowley to Haster, who had been walking behind Ligger and had unfortunately not been so much as splashed.
There are some things that are unthinkable. There are some depths that not even demons would believe other demons would stoop to.
"Holy water, you bastard," said Haster. "You complete bastard. He hadn't never done nothing to you."
"Yet," corrected Crowley, who felt a little more comfortable now the odds were closer to even. Closer, but not yet even, not by a long shot. Haster was a duke of hell. Crowley wasn't even a local councillor.
"Your fate will be whispered by mothers in dark places to frighten their young," said Haster, and then felt that the language of hell wasn't up to the job. "You're going to get taken to the bloody cleaners, pal," he added.
Crowley raised the green plastic plant mister and sloshed it around threateningly.
"Go away," he said.
He heard the phone downstairs ringing. 4 times, and then the answer phone caught it. He wondered vaguely who it was.
"You don't frighten me," said Haster.
He watched a drip of water leak from the nozzle and slide slowly down the side of the plastic container toward Crowley's hand.
"Do you know what this is?" asked Crowley. "This is a Sainsbury's plant mister, cheapest and most efficient plant mister in the world. It can squirt a fine spray of water into the air. Do I need to tell you what's in it? It can turn you into that."
He pointed to the mess on the carpet.
"Now go away."
Then the drip on the side of the plant mister reached Crowley's curled fingers and stopped.
You're bluffing, said Haster.
Maybe I am, said Crowley, in a tone of voice which he hoped made it quite clear that bluffing was the last thing on his mind.
And maybe I'm not. Do you feel lucky?
Haster gestured, and the plastic bulb dissolved like rice paper, spilling water all over Crowley's desk and all over Crowley's suit.
Yes, said Haster.
And then he smiled. His teeth were too sharp, and his tongue flickered between them.
Do you?
Crowley said nothing. Plan A had worked, Plan B had failed. Everything depended on Plan C, and there was one drawback to this. He had only ever planned as far as B.
So, hissed Haster, time to go, Crowley.
I think there's something you ought to know, said Crowley, stalling for time.
And that is? Smiled Haster.
Then the phone on Crowley's desk rang. He picked it up and warned Haster, don't move. There's something very important you should know, and I really mean it. Hello?
No, said Crowley.
And then he said, no, got an old friend here. Aziraphale hung up on him. Crowley wondered what he had wanted, and suddenly Plan C was there in his head. He didn't replace the handset on the receiver. Instead, he said, okay, Haster, you've passed the test. You're ready to start playing with the big boys.
Have you gone mad?
Nope. Don't you understand? This was a test. The Lords of Hell had to know that you were trustworthy before we gave you command of the Legions of the Damned in the war ahead.
Crowley, you are lying, or you are insane, or possibly you are both, said Haster.
But his certainty was shaken. Just for a moment he had entertained the possibility. That was where Crowley had got him. It was just possible that Hell was testing him, that Crowley was more than he seemed. Haster was paranoid, which was simply a sensible and well-adjusted reaction to living in Hell, where they really were all out to get you. Crowley began to dial a number.
It's okay, Duke Haster. I wouldn't expect you to believe it from me, he admitted. But why don't we talk to the Dark Council? I'm sure that they can convince you.
The number he had dialed clicked and started to ring.
So long, sucker, he said,
and vanished. In a tiny fraction of a second, Haster was gone as well. Over the years, a huge number of theological man-hours have been spent debating the famous question, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? In order to arrive at an answer, the following facts must be taken into consideration. Firstly, angels simply don't dance. It's one of the distinguishing characteristics that mark an angel. They may listen appreciatively to the music of the spheres, but they don't feel the urge to get down and boogie to it. So, none. At least, nearly none. Aziraphale had learned to gavotte in a discreet gentleman's club in Portland Place in the late 1880s. And while he had initially taken to it like a duck to merchant banking, after a while he'd become quite good at it, and was quite put out when, some decades later, the gavotte went out of style for good. So, providing the dance was a gavotte, and providing that he had a suitable partner, also able, for the sake of argument, both to gavotte, and to dance it on the head of a pin, the answer is a straightforward one. Then again, you might just as well ask how many demons can dance on the head of a pin. They're of the same original stock, after all. And at least they dance. Footnote. Although it's not what you and I would call dancing, not good dancing anyway. A demon moves like a white band on Soul Train. And if you put it that way, the answer is quite a lot, actually, providing they abandon their physical bodies, which is a picnic for a demon. Demons aren't bound by physics. If you take the long view, the universe is just something small and round, like those water-filled balls which produce a miniature snowstorm when you shake them. Footnote. Although, unless the ineffable plan is a lot more ineffable than it's given credit for, it does not have a giant plastic snowman at the bottom. But if you look from really close up,
The only problem about dancing on the head of a pin is all those big gaps between electrons. For those of angel stock or demon breed, size and shape and composition are simply options. Crowley is currently travelling incredibly fast down a telephone line. Ring! Crowley went through two telephone exchanges at a very respectable fraction of light speed. Haster was a little way behind him. 4 or 5 inches, but at that size it gave Crowley a very comfortable lead. One that would vanish, of course, when he came out the other end. They were too small for sound, but demons don't necessarily need sound to communicate. He could hear Haster screaming behind him, "You bastard, I'll get you! You can't escape me! Ring! Wherever you come out, I'll come out too! You won't get away!" Crowley had travelled through over 20 miles of cable in less than a second. Haster was close behind him. Crowley was going to have to time this whole thing very, very carefully. Ring! That was the third ring. Well, thought Crowley, here goes nothing. He stopped, suddenly, and watched Haster shoot past him. Haster turned and ring! Crowley shot out through the phone line, zapped through the plastic sheathing, and materialized full size and out of breath in his lounge. Click! The outgoing message tape began to turn on his answer phone. Then there was a beep, and as the incoming message tape turned, a voice from the speaker screamed after the beep,
"Right! What, you bloody snake!"
The little red message light began to flash, on and off, and on and off, like a tiny red angry eye. Crowley really wished he had some more holy water and the time to hold the cassette in it until it dissolved. But getting hold of Ligger's terminal bath had been dangerous enough. He'd had it for years, just in case, and even its presence in the room made him uneasy. Or maybe, yes, what would happen if he put the cassette in the car? He could play Haster over and over again until he turned into Freddie Mercury. No. He might be a bastard, but he could only go so far. There was a rumble of distant thunder. He had no time to spare. He had nowhere to go. He went anyway. He ran down to his Bentley and drove toward the West End as if all the demons of hell were after him. Which was more or less the case. Madame Tracy heard Mr. Shadwell's slow tread come up the stairs. It was slower than usual and paused every few steps. Normally, he came up the stairs as if he hated every one of them. She opened her door. He was leaning against the landing wall.
"Why, Mr. Shadwell," she said, "whatever have you done to your hand?"
"Get away from me, woman," Shadwell groaned. "I dinna know my own powers."
"Why are you holding it out like that?"
Shadwell tried to back into the wall.
"Stand back, I tell you. I canna be responsible."
"What on earth has happened to you, Mr. Shadwell?" said Madame Tracy, trying to take his hand.
"Nothing on earth! Nothing on earth!"
She managed to grab his arm. He, Shadwell, scourge of evil, was powerless to resist being drawn into her flat. He'd never been in it before, at least in his waking moments. His dreams had furnished it in silks, rich hangings, and what he thought of as scented undulance. Admittedly, it did have a bead curtain in the entrance to the kitchenette, and a lamp made rather inexpertly from a Chianti bottle, because Madame Tracy's apprehension of what was chic, like Aziraphale's, had grounded around 1953. And there was a table in the middle of the room with a velvet cloth on it, and on the cloth, the crystal ball, which, increasingly, was Madame Tracy's means of earning a living.
"I think you could do with a good lie down, Mr. Shadwell," she said, in a voice that brooked no argument, and led him on into the bedroom.
He was too bewildered to protest.
"But a young newt is out there," Shadwell muttered. "Enthralled to heathen passions and occult wiles."
"Then I'm sure he'll know what to do about them," said Madame Tracy briskly.
whose mental picture of what Newt was going through was probably much closer to reality than was Shadwell's.
And I'm sure he wouldn't like to think of you getting yourself worked up into a state here. Now just you lie down, and I'll make us both a nice cup of tea.
She disappeared in a clacking of bead curtains. Suddenly, Shadwell was alone on what he was just capable of recalling through the wreckage of his shattered nerves was a bed of sin, and right at this moment was incapable of deciding whether that was in fact better or worse than not being alone on a bed of sin. He turned his head to take in his surroundings. Madame Tracy's concepts of what was erotic